right, everybody. Once again, welcome to another Professional Goblins podcast. I am Scott Gladstein, and with me, as always, is my co-host,
Mike Miley,
and also
Savannah Broadway,
and the immortal, the person who is not a hobo who just walked in off the street, Ashley. Hello, and welcome to the podcast, Ashley.
Hi.
we were actually just talking that we generally know people better than you, but that's okay. I think we're going to become friends by the end of the evening. So do you want to give us the long and short of it, how things are going, and what you do and why people should care? Because I assume they should.
I hope so. I mean, I guess I'm a little biased about that. So hi, everyone. I'm Ashley. I am a writer and a game designer for Dungeon Masters Guild. I recently joined the Guild Adept program, so I've been working on some exciting projects with the Guild Adepts. And for the month of July, I ran the RPG Writer Workshop. So basically helping new writers write a one-shot module within 30 days. So that's actually how I connected with Mike, because I think he joined our Discord channel. So
I did. Yeah. I stumbled on it without realizing that it was a workshop. And then I realized, I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize you guys were like, this is my first piece. It's like, oh, shit. So I've been trying to be a little less.
What, Mike, you're telling me that wasn't your first piece?
Baseball.
Yeah. We have a lot of people in the group of all levels and stages of writing. My goal was just to basically help new writers kind of cut through the noise. There's so much information on the internet about writing a one shot. And I have friends too who are writing one shots for the first time, and they're just feeling kind of overwhelmed and daunted by the amount of information. So the workshop, it was fairly structured. I wrote lessons throughout the month. They were like email lessons just about how to structure your one shot, how to create a writing process that works for you, and how to play test, how to edit and revise. But everyone in the group, especially in the Discord channel, are of all stages and levels. So everyone's welcome. It's, you know, just basically a community now of people who are writing one shots, but it was a really exciting month to see what people are working on.
You have like academic credentials too, right?
I do. I went to graduate school for literacy studies. And while I was in graduate school, I did a lot of research on games. This was a few years ago, so most of my research was about video games, but I wish I would have done more on D&D and RPGs. But I really am passionate about how games kind of change the way we think and interact with each other, and how they can inspire us to be better storytellers. So that was what I did a lot of my research on. So and then I taught English 101. I taught English in high school. So I have kind of a background in teaching people how to write.
What was, did your thesis actually on video games? Because like when I was getting out of college, there was still a lot of contention of like which departments got to have video games. Was it the film people? Was it the literary people? Was it the computer people? Was it the philosophy people? Like they were all scrabbling. So like did that equalize or what?
So I actually did my thesis on cyber activism, like using the internet in terms of
no academic respect for games.
So but actually,
that was just because at the time it was during like the Arab Spring and like right around Occupy Wall Street. So it was really.
Oh no, sure. I'm not denigrating that or anything. I'm just like mad that the Ludologica project hasn't like gotten academic footing yet. Because like
I did. Hey, Mike. I was a fellowship in a research project, and I got to do a project on video games. So I did do a
project. I don't know. I feel like the video game community doesn't take literary criticism very well. I think we've seen a lot of evidence of that.
So hi, I'm Scott. My undergrad thesis paper was on pen and paper. I actually have an undergrad degree in that subject.
Yay!
So
that's
yes,
awesome.
I can tell you that is an arts program. It generally falls in with a lot of creative writing. My master's is in business administration. I have MBA. Mm-hmm. But yes, a lot of my degree was staged towards project management and educational games, like games with purpose. We call them serious. The subcategory was called serious games, which I always thought was very ominous and like, well, our games are more important. But no, it was basically how to convey concepts with it, and I geared a lot of it towards tabletop stuff. Mm-hmm. So
that's awesome. I wish in retrospect that I would have done more research in that space, but at the time this was kind of when ludology and game studies were kind of starting to transition into, I mean, this was a few years ago. So, I mean, I got to do a lot of really cool research projects. I did research RPG video games. So I did projects on like Oblivion and Skyrim, and using those in classrooms to inspire character creation and storytelling and things like that. So most of my research was educational focused, but using commercial games in educational spaces. So yeah, it was really exciting, but I feel like that's kind of continued into what I do now and thinking about how to write games and how to share games with everyone else and how they basically make the world a better place. Not to sound totally cheesy.
No. Welcome to our podcast. We are very cheesy about these topics. So speaking about the podcast, sorry guys, I have two cameras set up today. So if I'm looking over here, that's why. So if you guys are first time on the show, welcome. Wow, unfortunately, what are we at, Mike, 50 something?
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're 50 episodes in and it's your first one, oh boy, this is good. So if you guys don't know, we have a semi-scripted show. We have a few areas, everyone talks on them. And at the end, our wonderful guest has an option to cut, or option, a requirement, damn it. A requirement to give us something good that isn't college football.
Free topic,
yes.
Normally we kick off with a review, but our last guest did not give us anything to review. So
Ashley, send us something short.
Can we say normally we kick off with a review when we haven't had a review in
20
forever?
Episodes? 10 episodes?
I don't know.
Least?
I mean, like, how many fingers do you see, Savannah?
42.
It could be 43 or it could be 45.
It's all right.
The podcast tells you, Savannah. So yes, normally we do a review.
But say, I'm reading Starship Troopers right now, so I don't need any more fascism. Thank you. So the first section we have in our thing is going to be your favorite character or a game that you're currently in or a character lesson you learned. Does anyone have one? I have a weird one from Magic the Gathering, weirdly.
I can't remember. Did I talk about the Streets game?
I don't think so.
You've mentioned it, I think. But I'm not sure if that's because I'm aware of it because I know you or because you've talked about it on here.
All right. Well, I'll talk about the Streets then.
Okay.
Should I do that?
Yeah, Mike, take it away. I'll go last.
For Roll 20 Con, I ran a game called The Streets. And The Streets is this brilliant reimagining of Sesame Street by this artist named Dan Levy. And it's where, like, Elmo is a meth head and the Cookie Monster owns a strip club called Cookies, and like Kermit has this terrible past and Bert used to be a cop but now he's like had to leave the forest because Ernie's too much of a junkie, and that's where I set the game. It's in Detroit and I decided that Kermit is
obviously
like the boss man, so like think like RoboCop's Opticon, wasn't that the name of the corporation?
Yeah, I don't remember what it's called, but it's something like that.
Think of that, but like with Kermit at the very top.
Yeah.
One of the players is playing like a puppet magician who's been blacklisted by Kermit, so he can't find any work. And then one of them was a gigantic puppet ganger with like a little human buddy, and they were like drug dealers. And then the other guy was, a baboon muppet with an oboe. He just carried around this like instrument case with, I think, a smaller instrument in it, but also a gun.
So some mariachi stuff right there.
Yeah. So it started off, they went to a bar, and then Ralph is there, you know, playing on the piano. So they did like a little duet with Ralph, and they talked to Waldorf and Statler, because like in this Detroit Streets universe, they are like the masters of information brokering. So they tried to like pull some good stuff out of him. And then they get called by Bert, who's like, hey, I'm calling in my favors, because like all the characters owe something to Bert for when he was on the force. And he needs to get a bunch of money so that Ernie doesn't get killed by Elmo, because he's built up this huge drug debt, and Elmo is a meth head, so he's just going to kill him. So you have to, like, knock over the first national count bank run by, you know, the count. And so what they did was they stalked the bank manager, who was a vampire spawn, back to this dude's, like, apartment high-rise, and then fought him in the parking lot, and, like, one of the players, thank God, realized, oh, it's a vampire. So he just, like, lit a fire to get the sprinklers going, and the vampire, done, is running water. It was great. I was like, I knew that. Oh, that's fantastic. So then they impersonated this teller. Like, they went up to his apartment, took all his shit, and, like, walked in the next day as if they were the teller. And they got all the employees out, and they had this, like, elaborate plan where they needed to do, like, a fire safety drill. So the other people came in dressed as, like, firemen, and they broke into the vault. They took a lockbox that they don't know what was inside, but Kermit, like, demanded that they get it, and then the Great Knocko would be no longer blacklisted. At one point they talked to the count over the phone, and they had this guy kept like fucking, I think he was manipulating his roles, because like his charisma persuasion rules didn't go under a 15.
Oh,
like, I was like, yeah. But I mean, the game was going and everyone's having a good time. So, and they ended up knocking off, getting all the money, and then paying off Elmo in time to save Ernie. And then the great knockoff turned in the security box. And the reason, one of the reasons Kermit hates him is because he's got a familiar that looks like Kermit's nephew, the little.
Yeah.
So he like tried to hide that in Kermit's office to see what was in the box, but like just barely failed the check. They only saw that it was like a piece of paper. And I'm fairly confident that they're not actually going to watch this podcast. I will tell everyone here what it was. Anybody want to guess what was the paper? It was on the paper?
No idea.
No idea.
His marriage certificate to Miss Piggy.
Well, cheers.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to picking up the game. I think this weekend or next weekend, and seeing what happens to Great Knocko, and because they made some definite enemies knocking over the Count's bank. Oh. Nobody does that shit.
Wait, how many? Would you say one?
I can't wait to drop him. Oh yeah, that's exactly how it's gonna be. I'm gonna find some way to do it with numbers. Oh yeah.
How many millions you owe me? One. Two.
Doing the phone call was great.
And I know your love of the Muppets, Mike. So that was probably.
I do. I love the Muppets to death.
We had this discussion
this week that really upset me. Did you guys know that Jim Henson was a Christian Scientist?
No.
No.
So he could be alive right now, probably. But Christian Science. So no.
There we go.
Just, like, so sad, because like that was one of the best voices of the fucking century.
Well, everyone's a complex person. Ashley, do you have a good story for us?
Throwing
you on the spot.
Hi. Currently, my party is playing through Tomb of Annihilation, which has been awesome and a little.
Has there been a lot of annihilation?
Yeah, lots of annihilation. We just got to the Tomb of Annihilation, so. Yeah, it's been fun because I'm playing a barbarian in this campaign, and that's pretty different from the characters I usually play. I usually play characters who are a little bit more, like, kind of bookish, which is funny because I usually don't play wizards, but I play characters who are not super reckless. So this has been the best campaign ever to be, like, kind of crazy reckless in. So I don't know. I feel like there's been a lot of kind of epic moments. There's been quite a few times where I've been on my last death save. And there are two distinct battles where I rolled a nat 20 and I got to come back, and then it was like my turn. So I attacked. Like, it was just awesome to basically just like come back from almost death and then be able to like smite an enemy. So that's been kind of awesome. And I like
permadeath in there too, right?
Yeah. It's in it's like meat grinder mode. So you have to pass like a 15 to succeed on a death save, which is really hard. And in the
Lord. Would you say you might be annihilated?
We've had, amazingly, no one has died yet, and which is crazy because we've been preparing our backup characters the entire campaign, just because our DM is like, you need to have a backup character ready to go. But for some reason, we've been not lucky, because I feel like our fights have been pretty tough. But it's just been really fun to play a character who just isn't afraid to just act and act on her instinct. Like, I'm not playing like a total meat-headed barbarian. Like, I need my characters to have some level of kind of just, even if it's like street smarts, like I can't play someone who's like too dim-witted. It just doesn't really appeal to me. But she's a really cool character, and it's just been fun kind of like delving deep inside my own psyche and just like letting myself be a barbarian. And I've like really liked it, like a little too much. So that's been that's been fun to just kind of go a little crazy. But yeah, that's just a really fun campaign. I love the setting. I usually play more kind of traditional high fantasy setting, so it's been fun to play in Chult, which is this kind of beautiful jungle setting, and it has just like these just amazing kind of visual moments. Like, there's this like area that's kind of like a dry lake bed or a dry ocean bed, and there's this like all these like really vibrant colored coral, and just like the visuals that you get as you're playing through this landscape are just really cool. So yeah, that's been really exciting. We've been playing that pretty much since January, so we're getting close to the end of.
Have you played Storms of Zaheer?
Just for I have the not.
Neverwinter Nights 2.
Oh.
And it's in Chult, is why I thought of it. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's got an overland map, which is one of the easily the coolest things I've ever seen in a D&D video game, because like it mattered what your perception was and your survival, because it would change how you interacted, like when you saw NPCs on the map and if you could avoid them and stuff. Yeah. is amazing. If you like Chult, definitely check out Storms of Zaheer.
I'll have to check that out because I'm like kind of obsessed with this landscape now. I just think there's so much potential for cool storytelling. And I just finished a collaborative project with another writer that is set not in Chult, but kind of like off the coast of Chult in this like fictional island. But it's been fun to really like delve into learning about jungles, and there's like a volcano on it. And then just like researching the flora and fauna in the jungle setting has been like really fun.
So,
My Curse of Strahd group is actually, we do the Tubana of Annihilation, like when the GM isn't prepped for Strahd. And we play it with the same characters, just leveled up. Mm. But we're flavoring it as, you know, the characters keep having this weird reoccurring dream, you know, after the warlock totally slips something into the drinking water.
Yeah, warlocks kind of do stuff like that, so.
I mean, it's the last time they sent him to go get water, I'm just saying. That character clearly worked.
That works well for Curse of Strahd because dreams are kind of a recurring theme in that campaign, mm-hmm. So that's really cool. That's clever.
But you were saying, Scott?
Oh, I was going to say one thing that I've been fine. I started playing Pillars of Eternity. I don't know if you guys ever played that.
I'm familiar with it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I went in like, oh, this is going to be a really grim, boring, you know, Diablo clone. Oh my God, are they getting to Mesoamerican stuff? Oh my God, that's cool over there. That's cool. Look at that visual. Dude, now they're like aping like high Roman stuff. Cool. Look at that early Christian stuff. Ooh, like these have some really pretty things. But the story I'm going to tell tonight has more to do with player interaction than it does with actual rules. So I was about, when did Urza's Saga come out in Magic the Gathering? That's how old this story is.
94, 96.
So it was a few years after that, because I had Urza's Saga cards. Anyway, I entered this tournament at a local, my friendly local game store. And I actually did pretty well. Like, I was definitely a little punk, and I had no idea what the hell I was doing, but I passed the first two rounds somehow. I had a green-blue worm deck.
What kind of tournament was it? Is it a booster draft?
Is it no, it was come in with whatever the fuck you want. It was old school.
In Connecticut?
What?
In Connecticut?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a pretty difficult tournament.
Yeah, it was Dungeon or Dragon's Lair is what it was called. I don't think the store is still around.
it was like a really rich part of the country playing a game about being...
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like a high-level tournament. It was a local... just.
Sure, but... That, like,
yeah, it was fun. But anyway, so I was a teenager, and I ended up... come in, I won the first two rounds, and it's like adult. I'm like, oh, I'm doing great. This is awesome. Now, I have a worm deck, which means I have all high mana cost cards. And I'm like this little shit, like, oh, dude, I'm going to kick everyone's ass. My blue cards get out, counter, counter, counter. I'm playing against this guy who's just very nice, and he's very quiet. I'm talking shit, like, I'm going to kick your ass. And he's like, I got, don't worry, I have a you know, a dragon deck too. I'm like, oh, dragons versus worms, let's do this. And I'm getting ready, and he's just playing cards. And I'm countering him. I'm getting everything. I'm like, my first worm out. I'm like, oh, dude, you're fucked. He keeps getting, you know, minor dragons, whatever. And I get him actually pretty low in life. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to beat this guy. Everyone said he was so good. Then he flips over Day of Dragons, which makes a bunch of, like, I think it's like...
all flying 5/5s?
Yeah, something like that. A shit ton of flying dragons. He looks at me and goes, I'm sorry. I'm like... fuck.
My favorite one deck of those was when they did Desolation Angels. Because they had the kicker where, like, when you brought into play, it just destroyed all your land. But if you get the kicker, it destroyed everybody's land. Because, like, that was just it. The game was over and you have a flying 5/4 creature. So 4 turns from now, you know, the game's going to be done. Unless you happen to have a bunch of low mana cards that you don't because you're mid-game.
Like, so I ended up just, like... biffing it and eating it, and you know what that says to me? What I learned from that was, I don't care how assured you are of winning, don't be a dick because someone's gonna beat your ass. There's always someone better. And I shouldn't have talked shit. I don't even remember the guy, but like, he was a saint the way I was talking. And after that, I never talked shit in a tournament ever again. Even when I placed much higher later in another game, I still was just like, nope, good job, well played, everything. And also, I respect dragons a hell of a lot more now.
I got a standing ovation at a booster draft for making a counter deck and taking second place.
Dude, I said half my deck was a counter deck. Blue counter is just so much fun.
You bought it. I drafted one from Booster, Scott. That's why they gave me a standing ovation, because it was like, how the fuck?
That's hard. That's hard.
Yeah, well, it was when they it was the CISACE thing where you could do color stuff. So it was all, yeah. Anyway, not a Magic the Gathering podcast.
But anyway,
sportsmanship is important. Yes,
sportsmanship. And here, even at your D&D table, it's important. Going, fuck yeah, I kicked his ass, mother. That's great, but the thing is, though, remember that the guy next to you may have had, who just rolled a crit miss three times in a row? Not as excited that you're cheering so much. Like, let every, as a GM, the rules always, everyone has a chance of a spot to be in the spotlight every game. I don't care if you have to throw a random extra evil character so that Paladin can smite the hell out of him. Do it.
I started to do side quests for rogues because inevitably, at least one person in the party can't sneak around.
No.
So, like, it's just better for everybody if me and the rogue take an hour for him to go break into the vampire mansion or whatever the fuck we're doing, and then he can come back with the stuff and, like, you know, the whole game won't explode, and they'll get to do what they're actually designed to do.
So. I had a group that took a teamwork feat. I forget what exactly it was, but essentially it meant that as long as they all had the feat and they were all within X amount of distance from each other, they could take the highest modifier in the group as everyone's. And of course, the rogue just sunk everything. So they're a crowd of fucking ninjas. Just motoring around on this pirate ship, just murdering the fuck out of, like, they corner a guard, just murder the fuck out of them.
Savannah, I don't know if you had a proper chance to go. Do you want to, you have a story?
Yes.
Okay, go for it.
So, I'll discuss here in a bit. I did character creation for Grandma World, so I'll discuss that later.
Nice.
But to get into the mood, I played. We did a one shot last Sunday, and I played an old lady halfling, and she's 111 years old, and it was so liberating. Because it was like a murder mystery, like Murder on the Orient Express sort of thing. But in like the, I think it was in like Planescape. Not that we knew because we were on it, or did much because we were on a train. Not much sightseeing. Anyway.
So I just want to point out that we have Savannah playing an old woman, an old halfling, and feeling liberated. And Ashley over here playing a barbarian feeling liberated. And me feeling liberated by being a dick. And, so this is a liberation.
Mike's
over
here with Elmo the meth head.
We know you identify with him, Mike. We know.
Sorry, liberation comes in many forms. I usually play the barbarian. So for me, like, playing a frail little old lady cleric, which, to be fair, she wasn't actually frail. She had a 16 con. And a 16 dex, but she's, like, crippling around with her cane. Well, it's all for the excuse that, like, oh, there's this elf who's, like, making grand gestures and reciting poetry. I'm like, yes, I cripple by him and knock him in the shin with my cane. Or, like, I, you know, you get up, there's a disturbance at 2 a.m. I order tea. Really? Because, like, the kitchen's... I order tea. Like, you get to impose on people, and, like, no one suspects you of anything, and it's just fantastic. Like, you can play with so much shit when you're old and tiny. Like, she's, like, 3.5 feet tall. It was great.
I played an old adventurer at one point. That was pretty fun. I played... It was in a 5e game. I played the retired adventurer who came out of it. And everything, every time he leveled up and everything, he was reclaiming some of his old glory, and he was a cleric. A cleric of the war domain. So, and he would just go ahead and keep rambling on in the background, like, I remember a story when I had to cross a bridge, and everyone's like, shut up. Yes, back in my day, bridges didn't have handrails.
You need a bard, because then the party has to listen to you in order to gain the benefits of your party.
No,
that's why old man is a bard.
Well, what I did was I had him cast Guidance, was his thing.
Sure.
And his Guidance was telling stories?
Yes.
Probably longer
often,
than
that. Yeah.
Well, that was
time.
The other thing, is that there was, like, oh, there was this 100-year-long war, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, my character has, like, been alive for all of the war. And, you know, she would always, like, ruminate on the youth and how, you know, they're just not respectful. And, you know, back in her day, when she was in the war, what were the
ruining taverns?
Yeah,
the tavern industry can't deal with these youths.
Yeah. And like, I kept calling everybody whippersnapper, and it was fantastic. So I need to play with the world, ladies, clearly, especially in 5e, where there are apparently no age penalties.
No age penalties.
Yeah. So it's like, nope, I'm 111. Don't mind me. Like, I'm older than that elf over there. I aged a lot worse, but
I had to write something recently, and you know what I realized? Elves are tall in Pathfinder, are taller than humans, which they're not in almost any of every other game.
Correct.
And I was doing something with weight and height and translating to something else, and I'm like, whoa, they are just like, oof.
I don't know if that's as true as you think it is. I'm pretty sure
they have like 3 or 4 inches on humans, I think.
Yeah, I call them slender folk a lot of the time as a synonym. Or tall folk.
Do we want to move on maybe to the favorite working project?
Yeah.
All right. So,
You worked on Familiar's Pathways?
I actually have to talk about that in a different one, because I actually ended up writing for that one, and then it got released. So I have to go ahead and I'll put that in the next section.
No, you worked on it, so you can't.
Yeah, mine, never mind. So yes. So I got tapped late in the development cycle on that book. It came out on July 31st, and I was tapped like 2 weeks before that to help, because someone dropped on that book. And they're like, hey, Scott, can you write, 2,500 words on Familiars in like 24 to 48 hours, maybe. Actually, I think I had 4 days, and I'm like, you'll have it tomorrow. And I did. I had to do one round of editing, but it's actually a lot of fun. Familiars aren't something that a lot of people are familiar with.
Yeah.
I'm not even sorry on that one. I got to explore kind of how some of the things that they skipped and a lot of the math behind. I get to look at a lot of the math behind why they select certain creatures and what's a qualification for a first level familiar, as well as like what constitutes what's the appropriate CR for like 5, 7. Oh, yeah, I'll put it up. One second here. Yeah, you have to remember, though, when I put stuff up, it doesn't look very good.
Pathways is a free magazine for the Pathfinder role-playing game on issue 79 now, provided by Ray Publishing.
And yes. It is actually pretty cool. I have to share that because I didn't realize it was out until just now. So you guys, right before the show, so you guys should go check out Pathways 79. And I have one coming up in another one or two of theirs, I think, too, which is kind of cool. But yeah, they're awesome. Miranda over there at Wright Publishing is a saint for putting up with all the submissions from new people and old people that she does. Hi, you're awesome. But anyway,
hi, Miranda, if you're watching this.
Yep. So yeah, that's what I got. Does anyone else have something they want to talk about?
I got a bunch of stuff. I'm trying to think of which one I should talk about.
I'm not 100% sure on the NDA of what I'm working on, so to be announced.
All right, Savannah is working on a thing.
Yeah, yes. I gotta.
Ashley, what are you working on while Mike thinks of what he's working on?
Oh my gosh, I have so many things I'm working on. Let's see. This was announced, so I guess I can talk about it, but I'm writing a story for the new Eberron storyline called Embers of the Lost Wards in the Adventurers League official Eberron storyline. So I'm really excited about that. So those, I believe, we're releasing a new one shot every week starting September 21st. So there's going to be lots of awesome Eberron content coming soon. So I'm excited to be working on that. And then I have been writing kind of a series of one shots that are set in this kind of conflict between like angels and demons. That's what a lot of my work has been centered on DM's Guild. So I have the fourth installment in that series coming out in October. And that ties in pretty closely with the lore in Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes, which is cool because demons and devils and stuff, real cool. So it'll be kind of Halloween themed. And
I like it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. I love that supplement. I just enjoy all that lore and information and all the cool new creatures. And Yeah, I have a lot, a lot of stuff going on. So those are things that are coming up in the near future, though.
Savannah, the only thing I think you like more than Angels and Demons are Fae.
No, I feel like Devil's Edge out Fae.
Okay, but as long as they're mischievous.
I like Fae better than Angels, but I like Devils better than Fae.
Got it, got it. Very important. So, Mike, have you ruminated enough on what you want to talk about?
I mean, it's hard to think about anything other than the thing that I'm definitely not allowed to talk about.
Mike is also doing a thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I might be. We'll find out. But
the thing you messaged us about?
Yeah.
All right,
yeah,
so it is definitely a thing.
I will level the fuck up if I do. but not that. Mortal Kombat? I have Mortal Kombat coming up. So on my blog, I think starting at the end of this month or the beginning of next month, I stat out all the Mortal Kombat characters from 1 and 2. So if you wanted to play one, I provide rules for how you can build one raw using, you know, the core books and then Mystical Kombat.
So like Mike,
Scorpion and Reptile and Smoke and Baraka and Sonya and Goro, and like I managed to do pretty much all of them except for Kintaro.
So Mike, I got a question. We've had Smash trailer after trailer after trailer, man. When are you conquering every Smash character ever?
Oh no, Luis is doing that.
Oh, is he? Okay.
Yeah, he's doing it for Pathfinder, but I'm pretty sure he started running through them over on the No Direction
block. That's pretty cool. I didn't know about that one.
I do have Simon Belmont up on my website, though. So.
Which, guys, by the way, is now in Smash, if you don't know.
I saw that.
Luigi is
dead. I do like how they started out with, like, a Luigi's Mansion sort of thing.
And then he gets murdered. And then then Nintendo actually went ahead and said, Luigi's not dead, and that's, like, all it says. It says, Luigi's okay or whatever, and I'm like, well, I'm glad you clarified that, but we saw his soul literally get ripped out by death. I'm not sure how you qualify, like, alive.
Well, you know.
It's gonna be dope.
Still salty, but there's no Waluigi.
Yeah, I actually was harassing my friend who was giving live tweets about it, about him, like, tell it to me straight, boy! Do we have a Waluigi confirmation yet? No,
oh, they
no,
won't
not yet.
Waluigi, because nobody likes him except in a mocking manner.
That's what they say.
Yeah,
that's what they say.
I mean, I have a friend who cosplayed as Waluigi, and I will tell you right now that he did so in a mocking manner.
I will say...
See, I don't feel like that should matter, though. Like, come on.
I feel like it should. See, I mean, if I had a character that was only ridiculed, I probably wouldn't want to make them a main stage character or give them a lot of
spotlight. Dude, there's 100... There's, like, 100 characters at this point, including Echoes. Or 68 or something like that. You're telling me that every character on there is a total 100% serious thing?
I mean,
also, like, I don't know about mocking so much as, like, ironically, which is mocking adjacent.
Anyway. All right, so while Luigi aside, like, Nintendo leaves him, do we want to talk about our favorite new project that's not yours?
Yes.
I actually have a different one that is...
I think this came out since I first put the thing up.
I have a different one, actually. But go ahead.
Rolled Told is a comic book / D&D adventure that you can download for free! Sorry, people watching.
I can't put that up, Mike.
Oh. Well, that's okay. I put it in the Twitch. No, put
okay,
it in
cool.
The,
that's what I'm saying. You should do that.
If you go on Comixology and look up Rolled Told, RolledTold, you will find it. Issue 0 is free, and it looks dope and fun. It's got, like, a full comic inside and also a full D&D adventure accompanying that comic.
Cool. I was going to talk about Raft, but I think that's a really old project at this point. What I am going to talk about is what?
I have no idea. I don't know what Raft is.
Oh, very quickly, Raft is a survival game where you play on, guess what? A truck.
A raft. Oh.
but yes, you play on a raft in the middle of the ocean, and you're like a sun-beached, like drenched, or like a sunburnt, like orphan trying to survive with nothing but a hook and an endless supply of trash coming towards you.
You don't get a tiger?
What?
You don't get a tiger?
No, not yet. That's probably in the expansion. It's in an alpha, but it's in an alpha where it actually is an alpha because they keep changing what it like. You're like, oh, then we added this whole new subsection, and you're like, oh, the game looks totally different than it did last update. Like, period.
Is it
like,
VR, or is it just like...
You can do VR, but there's a VR version, and there's a computer version.
Oh, I may not check out the VR version.
I think there's a VR version. I think it has VR support at least. But the most terrifying thing is that you are constantly hounded by a shark.
Oh, good. It is just nightmare. I've seen some Let's Plays of this.
Yes, it is nightmare fuel. But anyway, what I wanted to talk about was, you guys are, I'm assuming that people here have at some point watched Extra Credits.
That sounds weird.
Really, Mike? This is the first, Ashley, back me up. This is like the most popular game pedagogy thing ever. Have you not seen it?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Oh, my God. Philistines. Philistines. Extra Credit.
I'm talking about Code Monkeys.
Extra Credit is a YouTube series that's been going on for like a decade plus now. They actually expanded into other topics at this point, but they look at games as a kind of from an educational academic standpoint, and they go into a lot of topics. And if I actually had to teach a game 101 course, I'd just say, here's like the first 100 episodes of Extra Credits, go read them or go watch them.
Ooh, they got a mention in Time Magazine.
Oh, dude, they're huge. The guy who does it, James, is a like consultant and has worked on many, 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 many games. The announcer was an animator for Pixar for a while. A bunch of the artists are like big game artists. Anyway, they're doing their very first game jam and they're opening it. One of the options is to do a tabletop game. And there's no prizes or anything. It's just kind of big celebration. It's a 48-hour game. It's over 3 days, but you have 48 hours once you start. No pre-existing stuff can be used. You don't know the theme till the end of it. And I convinced my editor to work with me, and I'm going to open kind of invite to everyone who wants to join us to jump in and do some tabletop stuff and show what the community, third-party community can do. I don't know. I think it'll be fun.
Okay.
But yeah, that's what I'm plugging. It's literally just called the Extra Credits Game Jam. So. Very hard to look up. Savannah, you got something for us?
No, I've been sort of out of the loop the past like week and a half. Lots of stuff going on, lots of mandatory overtime at work.
That's okay. All that fun stuff. I mean, yay, but
how's that new job working out?
I mean, it's what I expected out of manual labor with mandatory overtime. I put in my 2 weeks. It's a good feeling. Highly recommend.
Oh. No, I just got this one. I don't want to put my 2 weeks in. I like my job, though, now.
Oh, okay, fine. You can keep it. But if you worked my job, I would highly recommend.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Do you have any plans for what to do next?
So, on one hand, hopefully I'm moving to Fife here soon. If that doesn't go through, I have an interview with a temp agency on Monday. So, like, there'll probably be, a week or two where I'm in between jobs, but...
Which means you're free for editing.
I'm at a point where, that's fine. So.
Which means you have a week of editing, right?
And that's what it's going to be. Yeah, the Can't Talk About project is a very big editing project. Yeah. I can say that much. So that's what I'll be doing.
So, Ashley, what do you got?
In my PJs.
Yes.
Be great.
But so you guys all think I'm wearing pants right now.
I'm at 5 in the morning.
I am. But anyway, Ashley, what are you up to other than wearing pants, I assume?
I might be wearing pants. I will leave that up to the viewers to decide.
No, don't. This is the internet.
I'm just kidding. I'm definitely wearing pants because I worry that, something's going to happen while I'm, streaming and I have to, get up and I want, be prepared.
I know, right? That's part of my concern.
I know, right? You have to prepare your streaming outfit at least to be covered.
Yeah, figure out what's behind you.
Yeah, right.
Yes, I'm blocking the only, since this is not technically my it is my room, but it's not my room. There's something right back behind my head somewhere that I always try to block out because I can't move it and it is rather distasteful.
So oh, good.
Now I want to know what it is.
Oh, it's just a giant boob cup.
Oh, classy.
I know, and I'm always I just don't want that like next to my head.
I mean, fair.
So I put the Paizo Goblin next to it. So, but anyway, so what are you on other than what other projects do you have that you are not involved with, benefiting from, but you want to plug?
So a couple months ago, let me actually backtrack. So there's this awesome RPG that I love called Bluebeard's Bride. Mm-hmm. And I actually have the book here. And it's by Magpie Games. And it is a retelling of the Bluebeard fairy tale. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but it's basically a feminist, like, horror game. And it's really, the art in it is just, like, incredible. And it's built on the Powered by the Apocalypse RPG system, which is, yeah, which is such a cool system. And it really, like, lends itself well to so many types of games. But this,
yeah, Mike. Is, like, it's really cool, Mike.
Are you not fans of it?
No, the system is fine. I just, I ran games at a convention and I signed up to run them thinking it was a superhero apocalypse game. It was not. It was Masks, which uses Powered by the Apocalypse teenage superheroes, which I was not interested in running, but, like, it's fine. It went out.
I don't know a whole lot of game systems, so, like, when I learned 5e, I was like, okay, I'm only gonna do 5e for the rest of my life.
And then, systems are dumb. So,
I know, but I don't have a lot of time to, like, really learn and embrace it. Plus, I wanted to write for 5e, so I wanted to learn as much as I could. But then I started just seeing all these cool projects that were built on Powered by the Apocalypse, and I was like, oh, interesting rule set. Just because I like to see what's possible with different systems. So I am branching out. I just have to kind of prioritize those things in my life. But this particular...
I really like Powered by the Apocalypse. I just have to give Mike shit because that's part of my purpose in the world.
Yeah, pretty much. Let's say, I don't know anything about learning new systems. I haven't been spending, like, hours and hours and hours and hours, pouring over the Pathfinder 2 playtest. Man, that is a hard sentence to say.
I'm stretched across, like, 5 systems. Because I have to convert Pathfinder to 5e, I have to design in 5e, I have to convert 5e to Shadow of the Demon Lord. I have in this background stuff to do Starfinder and Pathfinder 2e, and then also the What's Old is New RPG. And then I'm sure I'm forgetting something.
Anyway, we're being jerks. So Bluebeard's Bride.
Yes,
that's another hard sentence to say.
That won in any last year, didn't it? Didn't it get in?
Yes.
This past year, I think.
Yeah.
Like last week, Gen Con.
Yes, because it came out, the core rulebook came out in, I think, October of last year, and then they've released a couple supplements for it. So the most recent supplement came out in June, so I'm counting that as, like, a recent project. But it's just, like, it's such an incredible book. It just has, like, the most amazing, like, detailed art. It has kind of a unique tone that I haven't really seen in other RPGs, but I'm really excited to run it. I'm hopefully going to run it for my birthday around Halloween. So it just has, like, such a cool, like, spooky vibe, but it really delves into kind of, like, the different, like, aspects of the psyche of being, like, a woman and different types of women. It's just, it's a really cool, like, approach to the story. It's, like, kind of abstract, but it's really beautifully and poetically written. So I just think it's such an awesome project, and they create some other really cool games, and that's Magpie Games. I think they're on Twitter and everywhere else, but yeah, I just wanted to share that because I think it's a really cool, interesting project.
I want to play it so bad.
It's so cool looking, and just the style of it is, like, really different and unique. For sure. That was kind of what drew me to it, but then the story itself is also really cool. So, yeah.
One of the really stronger parts of narratively designed games like that, or Fate, or Star Wars, the new Star Wars game, is that, like, you don't have to have implied themes to the stories and adventures that you tell with it. Like, in D&D, there are implied themes. Like, you are fighters, you are barbarians, you are wizards, it's expected to be sword and sorcery, it's expected that you're going to fight dragons and go into dungeons. But, like, they aren't hard-coded into the rules in the same way that in a narrative thing, where, like, the theme is that you are all young adventurers, and part of your thing is discovering your powers. So, like, discovery is a theme that is literally worked into the mechanics. So the way it interacts in the game is explicit as opposed to implicit.
God damn it, Mike. You made me think of something I forgot to mention earlier.
Save it for later.
It's coming out this week. We took the D20 system and made a bunch of, like, mini games based on it. So now we have, like, Fantasy Grand Prix and, like, D20. It was called D20 Obstacle Course, and it's totally not Ultimate Beastmaster. But for D and Ninjas and Takeshi's Castle and stuff. But, god damn. We've been working on that for a while, but yeah, like you're saying, it's all about, like, I like systems that mess with, like, what the assumption of the theme is, you know what I mean? How the mechanics interact with the theme is just what makes that a much stronger candidate for storytelling in my mind than something like, you know, even a video game. A video game is like a movie. It tells a very linear story, even when it's not linear. But I don't know.
Narrative RPGs are kind of like parade floats. And yeah, major, huge, like, investment RPGs like D&D and Pathfinder are like Porsches. And I think the best way to do this
are
is
like
to buy
what?
A Porsche.
Porsches.
Or Corvettes. The best way to do it is to buy the Corvette and then just spray paint whatever the fucking theme you want on it, which is what I do, right? Like, so when it's Mrs. Vakuma, the theme is supposed to be, like, dark side of the force kind of stuff and dignity. So I just made them into attributes. Just like strength or charisma, and then the hypercore, it's about luck and reputation, and the wasteland, it's about being irradiated. Like, just sprawl it on the side of the car, you know?
Subtlety.
It's not, well, that's what I'm saying. It's supposed to be explicit, because that's what the point of the narrative design is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to Pathfinder, because
Starfinder
Pathfinder
stuff.
Playtest dropped.
Hey, Mike, has anything happened in Starfinder or Pathfinder recently?
Yes.
What has happened in Starfinder? Please, or Pathfinder, damn it. Please tell me.
They sell out in Gen Con? I wasn't there. I didn't really
I assume.
I don't know. I remember they sold out of Starfinder last year. But yeah, it's out. You can download it for free from Paizo.com. They want you to. I have a lot of thoughts. My biggest one, I think, is the little app. Okay. So they've got new coding systems for like how you read the book, right? There's a lot of symbology involved in the same way that you saw it in Starfinder. Except a little more reinforced. And their symbol for it's a basically a full round action versus it's only like half of a round of actions is two diamonds versus like, I think four diamonds.
It's a diamond with like, an extra side on the side, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Why aren't you guys using more of shapes?
So I actually wrote, because I'm reading this with the eye for future development. I worked out a system that we're going to use, which is Unicode characters, and it's going to be like a, for the actions, it's going to be a solid diamond for what is it, normal actions. So we do, guess what? One for one, two for two, and three for guess what? Three actions.
I mean, I don't think it needs to be as like obvious and coded like the old White Wolf stuff with like, here's the dots. Like, it doesn't have to be like that. But if I'm a 50-year-old player and I don't have amazing eyesight, like, determining if this thing's got two actions or three actions to activate it is going to require me to go like this. Like, just put a motherfucking shape, another shape in there for the extra one. We'll all know what it is because you turn the diamond 90 degrees. Like, yeah. I don't know. I feel like it's low bait. Like, they want us to tell them that, so they're like, oh, yeah, we made this change.
One thing that I thought was really weird. So the races are now called ancestries.
That's a good move.
Yeah, I like that move. And then I'm like, oh, I thought about that and went, before I got through the section, I'm like, oh, so if I want to play a half elf, I just have to have the elven ancestry. That makes sense. And then I read how they actually did it, and I was like, oh, you have to be human and spend your racial feat on being a half elf.
I don't know why they didn't just blow that out. Yeah. Like, why can't I play a halfling dwarf?
The other suggestion we had when we were talking was just, why don't you have a general racial feat that just says, hey, pick another attribute from a race, or you get the tag from the other race, et cetera, et cetera. I'm a half dwarf, half elf. Cool. Like, why wasn't that their design ethos, you know? I'm writing a huge article on this. I got 15 pages of notes at the moment.
It's going to be a very huge article.
But yeah.
I have 15 bullet points.
Well, the best part is it's going to end up being, like, super condensed because I wanted people to read it on Medium, and that's where I write, and they tell you how long it's going to take you to read. So I actually think that's a smart idea. But I feel the creeping tendrils of 4E in a lot of this stuff. Like, this, I know, I don't know, it's hard to articulate, and I'm going to have to articulate it better when I write it, but there's a lot of stuff that's like, this is a special action that does this. I'm like, but this other guy's a special action that does the same thing. Why isn't this a general rule? There's a lot of things that are very specific when they should be a general rule. And it's like, why are we getting rid of that?
I like that they included sign language off the bat.
Yes, I actually made a note on that. I like that they're doing. One thing is they're using you.
Well, I remember in 3.0, like, everybody was like, oh, yeah, I take draw sign. And you're like, where did you learn draw sign? And, like, I can tell you 50 different off-the-wall fucking ridiculous explanations for people telling me, oh, well, this is how I learned draw sign. like, just, I'm glad you guys just included it. Everybody can have sign language, half in sign language, whatever, whatever, whatever. That's great.
One thing, I'm not going to articulate it well until I write it out, but there's a lot of things that are mechanics in place where there should be fluff. You know what I mean? There's a lot of times where I'm like, oh,
I felt that a little way about backgrounds. They're giving you ability boosts. Yeah,
exactly. That was one of the ones I made a note on was, so your background, it's like, okay, you get one free ability score boost from this, from these two, and then a free one. I'm like, well, what's the free one have to do with my theme? Why isn't that just something tied into my character creation? Why is this a thematic thing?
I'm opposed to ability boosts in the backgrounds, period. I feel like
I see why they did it. It worked well in Starfinder with the themes, and I think that if they just had it like that, that'd be fine. I think the free ability boosts, aside from the humans, are a little weird, because it's like, you get a free ability boost, which ties into your race, but
well, it doesn't part tie of that into is your race. They have not implemented an ability cap, but they've implemented an ability stopgap.
Yeah, well, so it's like, 18 at first.
Right, and once you hit 18, then you got to basically pay double for whenever you increase.
Yeah, but it's 18 at first, and then you can go up from there.
Yeah.
So they have one on there. I am going to be people are kind of polarized from this, from what I've read. I really don't like residence points. I get why they did them.
I'm not far enough in to make that judgment. I saw that Bart or Alchemist gets lots of them, and I'm like, yes.
So here's the thing. If I introduce a new player to the game and
residence
I go...
Residence points are for using with magic items.
Yeah, so here's the thing. If I introduce my friend to this game and I go, first edition, or, you know, 3.5 or whatever, or 5e, yeah. I put... How many rings can I have? What type of magic equipment can I have? Well, you can have some in your ring slot, your head slot, your chest slot, whatever, as long as they don't overlap. Okay. And if I introduce a new person who's never played a D&D game to this, I go, all right, now calculate out your residence points and figure out how many items you can have equipped to your character, and the alchemist gets more. It's based on your charisma, and I'm just like, that's a fun barrier, and it wasn't an issue in Pathfinder. It wasn't like a whole.
No, it's not. It's a fun reward. Reward for all the charisma characters get kicked out at the knees if they're not a sorcerer.
I don't know, but here's the thing: like, it feels like to me that it was solving a problem that wasn't a problem.
No, Christmas trees was definitely a fucking problem.
Then say you have two magic items. Like, don't give me a score for it. I don't know. People are very polarized about it right now.
Later in, I think it's going to be all right. That is definitely something I see a lot of people complaining about, though.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's an added complexity. So.
Yeah, and it's not there's no tangible, like, equivalent. I can't envision what a resonance point is. You know what I mean?
I mean, we have resonance. You guys weren't involved in the first Verantia book, but we essentially had resonance.
I had an alternate key-based subsystem, or kind of chakra aura-based subsystem in one of our books that was kind of like that.
Magic item controls have been home-ruled for Pathfinder by lots of people, man. So implementing them in an official capacity, I think, is a good idea. It's definitely going to change because it's the number one thing people complain about, but I don't think it's...
One thing I like a little bit more is, and we're going to kind of not go on for 30 minutes about this, so...
Yeah, we've got 5 more minutes is tops.
All right.
Arcane spell list, divine spell list, occult spell list, yes! Primal spell list, take me!
I love that.
Yes. Agreed on that.
Totally. I loved that, and I like the idea that it's implied that you can totally just go ahead and add a new spell list if you need to if you introduce another, like, school. I like how they do 10th level spells. I like that all the partial casters are now 9 level casters.
I got an art complaint.
Yeah, well, that art's not final at all.
Okay, good. Because, like, the halfling art, the giant V faces, is just way too much. It just looks like they smooshed the face like this.
Well, something I thought was funny is they have a section. Actually, that's not a complaint anymore because I realized they have that. You can't really multi-class anymore. It's the 4E version where you take a multi-class feat and you get some stuff from it. I don't like that. I like being a fighter 5, bard 2, sorcerer 6. Like, I love that weirdness. Legendary skills bug the hell out of me. So if you guys don't know how most things work, is there are a bunch of different strengths. There's untrained, trained, expert, master, legendary. And unless your class has a signature skill, you can't get to master. And there's only a few ways to get to legendary on anything. And those are all tied to class. and there is no way to make your thing a legendary legendary skill, which means you can't get legendary on. I can't make an intimidating fighter. Not a legendarily one.
Like I said, I only read up to the barbarians, which you said also before we started, but now it's very clear that you have read beyond that.
I got up to about bard and...
My last thing is to complain about class tables. And I know, I feel like it's low bait, but there should just be a column for feats.
I can see that.
It looks cluttered now, and I feel like they're just waiting for, 300 people to be like, hey, man, give us a column for feats.
So where I've read up to is I've read up to in depth up to the end of Barbarian and Bard, I think. But I have had discussions with my design team where we went through the book together in a general sense, and we went over some stuff that they had, because they're ahead of me. So they talked about some stuff. I looked in at the section and we talked about stuff. I'm okay with how they're doing AC, but there's some wonkiness. Like, you can become trained in unarmored stuff and unarmored combat, which is great, except only the monk gets it. And there's a barbarian archetype thing or a feat theme thing where you get to be an unarmed barbarian, an unarmored barbarian. And it only
all of the class and race features in Pathfinder 2e have been broken down into heritage feats and class feats that you get access to. So, like, one of the cooler things about this is that I have never, any of my characters in Pathfinder, ever used that anti-giant ship. It's never come up, not one time.
I don't like that.
Now you don't have to take that as one of your abilities at the race will start. You just choose a different racial feat.
So, Mike, here's what I feel really strong. This one I feel really, really, really strongly about. Races now, the only thing that you have is your size, a ability score, and any perceptive based stuff. And I think one of them has
a specific pool of feats accessible to your race.
I'm getting to it. So the problem ends up being that some of the feats are pretty similar. So there's a time where you can go ahead and be like, all right, so there's a time when I was looking, we were building an elf and a dwarf. And we're like, oh, the elf and dwarf are pretty similar except for their HP. I mean, I get a little bit different weapons with my weapon focus thing. And I feel like there's not as much flavor to the race. I wish they had like two more qualities to them that made them, oh, that's interesting and unique. That's going to be a lot harder to do with some of the higher, as we in the Pathfinder 1 race point races, you know what I mean? Things that have bigger mechanics tied to them, it's a lot harder to do now. I don't know. Yeah, I really don't like that it guts the theme, because that means like two elves.
I don't feel like it's got the theme. It's just like spread it the theme totally. Out. Because there are lots of things that humans are good at, but if you strip us down and you raise us in a white room, we're basically not going to be good at most of those things.
Yeah, but we're not talking about people raised in white room. We're talking about characters.
Exactly. So having a huge pool to choose different things from to make you unique humanness unique makes more sense.
Here's the thing. I like that. I wish there was one or two things that
City dwarves be good at fighting giants?
That's fine. I'm saying I agree on that front. I disagree that there shouldn't be anything further than what they have. I think there should be one or two things that, like, even one racial feat that every dwarf has that makes them tied to something, because it cuts the tie between the mechanics and the lore to me. Because most dwarves then are just not good at most things.
It, and then it's a rope.
Anyway, so we've hit our 5 minutes here, Mike. So let's continue on so we don't leave Savannah and Ashley behind.
Savannah, you got to read this. What's wrong with you?
Ashley has muted herself because we've been talking so long. That's totally fine, Ashley. We got off on our tangent, but hey,
I have nothing to contribute here. I feel bad.
That's fine. It can't come out. Also, by the way, Valoros is a sword and shield fighter now, not a two-weapon fighter. I'm very upset. Anyway, 5e news and speculation.
Eberron came out.
Was he ever really a good two-weapon fighter,
though? No, he wasn't, and that's fine. But anyway.
Eberron came out, and Ravnica is on the way. Ravnica's getting a physical book. Is Eberron getting a physical book, or is it just the PDF?
Eventually, yes, but it'll be sold, I believe, still through DM's Guild, so it'll be just a print title available there. But eventually, after some of the UA content is playtested more, so it's on the agenda, according to Mike Morales and according to what I know. So
like updating the file until they're like, okay, it's done. Now the print version's ready.
Pretty much. And if you get the Wayfinder's Guide to Eberron now, you get all the updates that come after that. So it's, I think it's a pretty rad deal.
Yeah.
How about the Blog of Holding analysis? Did anybody else see this?
No.
Somebody went and did all the work for crunching the 5e monsters and came up with their own charts for balancing the CR and stuff and explained it in depth.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, because I think we all know that that table on page 274 of the Dungeon Master's Guide is at best used for light guidance. So, yeah, I don't know. I've been using it to double-check math on stuff, and for the most part, it's pretty accurate. It's pretty good. I'm pleased with it. Check out Blog of Holding. He's got a great breakdown of the monster stats for 5e.
They're doing a $170 gift set, which is the first three books in a fancy GM screen.
With the fancy covers, too, right?
They're fancy covers. $170, and it's friendly local game store only. So, yeah, break out that checkbook, those checkbook guys. That's
I'm glad they finally support friendly local game stores. They need it, man.
They do, but like...
Also, if you don't write checks at your friendly local game store, they probably don't take them.
Yeah, okay. Break out your... I was midway through the sentence, and I'm like, you should probably use a credit card, but I'm committed.
Yeah. That was always the worst when people paid with checks.
Or like, you can always be a check for like something really small, like groceries. Do you accept $10, written checks for your groceries, the old lady says, and you're like, oh, fuck, really?
I mean, it's better than, like, the last place I worked, we took checks, but they could only, like, if they were over $100, we had to, like, run them through this machine, and it was all thing, and just don't do it. Just don't do it.
Trust us, your friendly local game store wants cash.
Yeah. there's a really weird article on CNBC, because you don't really hear a lot about, like, I guess we hear a lot about it because we're in the industry, but like, actual, like,
came out.
The actual, like,
esports.
What?
Esports.
Yep. I was gonna say, you don't hear a lot about, like, D&D and stuff in, like, the business sense.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the dude, the Hasbro CEO. The Hasbro Watsi CEO that came out and was like, D&D esports is our next thing.
Oh, God, no, I hadn't heard about that. Mike, tell us about
e-sport,
it.
Though? Like, that seems like the wrong term.
But he was also referring to, I thought, more like Magic the Gathering and like card type stuff. At least was my interpretation. Like, I definitely think that what he said seemed kind of ridiculous, but it might have been taken out of context a little bit. But yeah, can you imagine D&D? Like, it's just what, like PvP or whatever?
Well, it would be either PvP or like dungeon runs that are timed or something. There used to be a way that they did a sort of league back in, I think, second edition days.
So we're going to get X-Crawl, basically?
Yeah, it was X-Crawl, essentially.
Yeah.
But what most people, like, I think Owen put it best. He was like, this is just a CEO. He's CEO trying to, like, bring confidence to shareholders.
Yeah.
Like, they're doing well. He wants them to buy more stock. That's all that's happening here. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
So, like I said, there's an article on D&D's growth in CNBC.
Entirely different thing, yeah.
They had double-digit growth this year, which is kind of cool. But the weird thing is they credit it to Stranger Things. People saw Stranger Things and saw D&D, therefore double-digit growth. Yeah, and I'm like, no, it's just been doing really well as a brand, and like, they put out a really solid 5e edition. I think that's really what it is. They're engaging with their customers. They're growing their online market. Wow. They also did pretty good with Magic the Gathering. They were hit hugely by the Toys R Us bankruptcy.
The people getting into D&D are doing it via Critical Role. Like, that's the big draw. Stranger Things, I'm sure, had like a small impact. But
yep.
Critical Role.
So they literally lost 7% of their revenue when the Toys R Us bankruptcy happened. I actually worked at a company that basically went bankrupt because Toys R Us went bankrupt. And there's still litigation for it. Toys R Us filed bankruptcy, and now they are not really handing out the money that they have.
America. They have stores elsewhere.
Yes,
they're in Japan. I know.
Well, they're in Japan and Europe, and they're closed in Canada and the U.S. And they're a different financial entity technically. So they're gonna hit with like charging order protections and like charging order stuff, which is like claiming that yes, you are affiliated, don't be a dick. And it's a very long, legacious process. The logistics of splitting your assets into different companies is a tried and true tactic that many businessmen have used for generations. Legacious, yes, that is a word, Mike.
Is it really a word?
Legacious means it means pertaining to legal stuff. A legation. There's
not litigious.
But yeah, I was thinking litigious.
Is it litigious or is it legacious?
It's definitely litigious. That's why I wrote it down, because I was like, legacious sounds fucking amazing. I want to use that for something.
Yeah.
And I want to forget you said. Sorry, Scott.
I'm glad.
It's an amazing word that you invented.
So apparently,
I accept this.
It is a word. But only according to Urban Dictionary, so I don't think that counts yet. Living language, I invented a word.
It's getting there.
Yep. Let's see. Do you want to talk about other RPG news?
Yeah, The Witcher came out and got a bunch of awards, didn't it?
I don't know if it got did it get a bunch of awards?
I don't know. There's a lot of buzz.
No. It just got announced, dude. It's,
No, I thought it came out.
Yeah, it just came out. It didn't. Did it win awards when it...
Oh, no. There was just a lot of buzz because it came out and people bought it.
Yeah, I would say. It's 360 pages long, full color, has some very pretty art, actually. Retails for $50, has four races, humans, elves, dwarves, and witchers, and offers players the choice of 9 classes. I don't know what those were because I did not write them down.
And we talked about this the last other show. The it wasn't the Cyberpunk 2020 guy who made it. It was his son.
His son and his wife.
What? Okay.
And his son and his wife, who since he passed on it, literally says, I legally will not have anything to do with this book. I will not contribute to it. I think it's a really cool book, but I am hired by a different person, and these guys are doing it on their own. Because they actually have their own, you know, writing credits, and they're, you know, worth mentioning in their own right, not just in the same as... Oh, his wife and kids. And for the record, they are Lisa Pondsmith and Cody Pondsmith. This note was from a really long time ago. Any nominations, guys? Go put them in.
Thanks, they're done. Next year is the anniversary, though, I think.
Of the Emmys?
The 20-year anniversary or something. Yeah, Morris was like, oh, I'll have to come to Gen Con or something.
It's cool. Does anyone else have any RPG news?
No, I can't think of anything.
All right. Other media of interest. That one's really old. We talked about that last time, I think. Let's see. We talked about Ant-Man yet?
Ant-Man and the Wasp. It was pretty good.
It was pretty damn good. I took my grandma went to it with me, and she liked it. So whatever that's worth, that's something. There are 2 post-credit scenes. Don't spoil it, but. Just sit through two of them. Next one up is what's it called?
Ant-Man and the Wasp will be the last Marvel Disney movie on Netflix.
Yep. Because which really pisses me off. Like, I know why they're doing it. They're trying to launch their own streaming service, but I don't want to pay for another fucking streaming service.
Yeah, I was gonna say no one needs another streaming service.
Yeah. Want to know what the end game is? It's gonna be 6 major streaming services.
Ew.
I'm just telling you because there are 6 companies that own 95% of all American media. So
well, here's the thing. The reason Hulu exists is because a lot of them went in together. Fox and Disney both owned large stakes in Hulu. It was supposed to be that they put everything on there. Now that Disney has, more shares because guess what happened? They bought Fox. Oh, yeah, that's also a thing that happened. they now hold a huge percentage stake in Hulu. And they decided, no, we're not going to use Hulu. We're going to go use our own service. By the way, Disney also owns ESPN. And ESPN is not going to be on their streaming service.
Oh, separate streaming service.
It's on its own separate streaming service.
Oh, my God.
But there may be a bundle deal, they said. Because, you know, that's great. But the Netflix Marvel series are going to stay on there.
Marvel VR game has come out, but I haven't had a chance to play it.
I've heard people say it's good.
I imagine it is.
I've been reading Starship Trooper, and oh my god, the fascism, I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be a parody.
I mean, that makes sense.
The movie is definitely, well, the funny thing about the movie is,
the movie's definitely satire.
So the thing was, it came out and people didn't get that it was satire, which is the cringiest thing
ever. Is that kind of like when people thought that Colbert was actually like a Republican?
Yes, yes.
Weird show.
Well, for the first like month, to be honest, I thought he was too. When it first came out.
I've always had a bad feeling about his show because I don't think it was accomplishing quite what everyone felt it was accomplishing. Because, yeah, a lot of people just thought, oh, yeah, he's Republican. Like, oh, fuck.
Well, the weird thing is there's actually a story about him where they said, well, how do you think you're doing as a journalist? And he went, I'm not a journalist. What are you talking about? He's like, I'm a comedian. Don't get the two confused. And then they tried giving him an award for being a journalist, for journalistic integrity. And he said, I should not get this award. And he literally went on for a few minutes rant saying, why am I the one getting this award? You guys should be getting one. And the reason they gave him the award was mostly to spite everyone else for being dickheads and kind of losing their moral center and saying the fact that Colbert is the guy who is telling you straight because he's a comedian. He should not be getting that. It's like he keeps insisting he's not a journalist. Like, I agree. But he also makes a note that he says, look, we have a week to prepare a show. And most of these guys are in a 24-hour cycle, so we can actually spend time and money and everything to actually go, you know, investigate stuff. So, but anyway, any other media of interest? All right, I think we want to move on to Kickstarters, though. I think the one I submitted is totally done by now.
Money Cook
no, it's not.
Another one now.
It's not.
Oh, okay.
Steve Jackson Games is bringing back Fantasy Trip. They let's see, at the time was like almost like 2 weeks ago, I said it was at 137,000 out of their $20,000 goal. It is now at almost 200,000, so 10 times their initial goal, and they have 14 days to go.
Didn't they just downsize?
What,
just downsize? They fired people,
did they?
Sure they did.
Well,
I remember that post about it. It was like, we over-speculated and we had to let people go.
Well, hey, guess what? Here's their salary back.
I hope so, yeah.
But I don't think they're going to rehire them. Anyone else have a Kickstarter they want to talk about?
I mean, I guess the obvious one to mention is the Expanse role-playing game from...
Yes.
That's not the one I was going to mention.
Yeah, but I mean, they're doing great. So, I mean, pledge if you want to, but it's not like they're hurting, so.
Well, let it be known that we contributed in some small, insignificant way to the rise of the Expanse, which is actually a pretty good IP. I just haven't delved into it as much as I'd like.
Monty Cook Games do another one called Your Best Game Ever, which on the front of it is just good for everybody. But then they've got stuff that they're adding on and unlocking. Like, I saw Sean K. Reynolds is doing some sort of horror game now as a stretch goal. Got unlocked, which is awesome.
So, Mike, what is this Kickstarter, though?
I believe it is like game mastering advice. And
Okay, cool.
I know that for, like, with the Black Cube and all that, when they did for Invisible Sun, there's a thing that you could get where essentially you get a year's worth of, like, I don't know if it's content or stuff or, like, I really don't know what it entails, but, like, you get direct assistance from the folks at Monty Cook Games.
That's cool.
For your specific game. Like, they have an entire platform for your group.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. Admittedly, like, altogether it costs, like, $600 or something.
I can see it. I've always been interested in the idea of, like, hire a GM for the night, and I know that's a thing, but I'm really wondering when the day where someone, like, it becomes a viable small-time profession or part-time profession, you know what I mean?
For some people,
I don't know if it's ever really going to get there. It would be nice, I suppose, but...
There are people who do that now.
Yeah, I know there are people who do it now, but I'm saying, like, it's not, like, a widespread thing. I'm wondering when it's going to, like, really widespread.
I don't know that it...
I don't know if it can. But I'm interested to see where that goes. I've always kept an eye on it, like, because I'm happy to sell my Friday night to somebody. That'd be fun. I don't mind.
There's a lot of weird weird things happening with the RPG markets.
Yeah, well, guess what? That's what we're here to talk about. Weird stuff in the RPG market. So, Ashley, it is fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you want to view it, time for your discussion topic. I think we got about 10 minutes or so. So, what, may I ask, is your...
besides college topic? Football.
And besides college football. We had someone come up and go... Well, we had someone come on and go, well, we always talk about college football. And we all
just Jason like... just used to be a teacher, and he wants to challenge us because we're younger than him and we learned something.
And we were just like, what?
I don't know that I learned anything, though. I appreciate your efforts, Jason, but I don't know that I learned anything.
So well, Ashley... I remember at the end, he was like, see, you could talk about college football for 10 minutes in that fucking smarmy teacher shit voice.
I mean, sounds about right, yeah.
So, Ashley, what is it that you want to talk about?
So first, I have a Kickstarter that I wanted to share.
Oh, sorry. Please.
No, no worries. I don't want to interrupt, but
Interrupt. We'll keep talking until sharing. You stop. Stop us.
I went to the local gaming convention back in June. It's called RageCon. And while I was there, I got to play test a game called Audacity, and it's like a card party game. And it's spelled Oddassity. And it's basically, it's like a card game. It's a pretty simple premise, but basically you get the chance to kind of dare other people to do like silly things. And then you get like points based off of that. But they have 10 more days in their Kickstarter. They've raised about $7,000 and they need 10,000. But it was a really fun game. So, I mean, I'm hoping that they're successful because it was fun to be able to play it, but.
They'll make it.
Yeah, as Mike and I can attest, the end of a Kickstarter is always the part where you end up getting
their statistical chance of failing is extremely small at this point.
Yep.
Yeah, like, that's great.
Because it always starts with a huge bump, and then it kind of pitters off, even drops a little bit. And the last like week or so, it just explodes. I think it's because they toss it on
there. You make almost nothing.
Well, definitely.
Magical Girl RPG.
Just
look up Magical Girl RPG Kickstarter, you will find Domina Magica, and I can't believe I forgot about it. It's already funded the first day. Yeah, I'm sure they're going to go great.
Anyway, back to Ashley's Torment. What do you want to talk about?
Since you all are fellow creators, I would love it if you could share just like one piece of advice you have for new writers.
I actually have one that I've been thinking about and talking with people about a lot, so that's actually really serendipitous. And Mike, that is a word!
Yeah, it is.
Yes.
But,
serendipitous? Yeah, yes. Serendipitous.
I know. I'm earning my respect back. One thing I came across a friend of mine who wrote something and submitted to me. She's going into her master's for creative writing. I looked it over and I started realizing all these errors. And I'm like, oh, I see what she's doing. It's the difference. I think a good solid definition, and this is a very nebulous concept, so not really. For what a professional writer has to do is they have to be able to write for an audience, not themselves. I mean, there's always something of yourself and you're always writing for yourself to a degree, but being able to use that voice where you, in that mindset where you're writing for another, learn to write for an audience. It doesn't matter in an impartial audience, not like your family, like go ahead and put up your stories on like Wattpad or something and ask for critiques because it's not very nice. Post them on 4chan, watch people rip them apart. No, don't do that. That's a bad idea.
Don't do that. Don't go into 4chan. Just run.
Just avoid it, yeah. No, but yeah, write for an audience. Writing for an audience is the hardest thing to learn. Like, there's times I've been like, oh, that'd be a really cool concept. No one wants to see that, though. No one. No one's going to buy that. No one's going to look at that. And kind of being able to rework that to be able to fit, like, is a skill that I think all professional writers should have. Does that kind of fit with what you wanted, Ashley?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
I just want a quick note. I have two very large books about a world called Ass Kiss that people gave me to write. Just so we understand, like, I was people Ass Kiss. Ass Kiss, everyone. It's not spelled clever. Okay. My advice would be to write every single day. Writing is a skill, just like playing basketball. If you don't play any basketball, you don't dribble, you don't shoot, and you come out a week later and you throw it at the net, you're going to be like, what the fuck? I'm 2 feet off. And it's the same way with writing. So even if you're only writing like 100, 200, 300 words, just write something every single day.
On that note, I have what I call my my workspace doc, which is literally bulleted lists of ideas and concepts and things just to think on. My second edition of it just finished up. after 100 pages, it took me about a year. That's all it took.
And even if you don't publish it, or if it's
no, no, God, no. Those are my notes.
Maintaining your skill level.
Yeah.
Yes.
So just something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Savannah, thoughts?
I suppose I have two mini bits of advice. One is, yes, you're going to turn it over to an editor. Please do some editing yourself first.
There's this thing called development.
If your publisher provides like a formatting guide or a style guide, please use it. Your editor will appreciate you much more for it.
Most of the time, you can just save as that document too. And then
just use those formats. The format brush, like Format Painter, is your friend. That, and I would say have a creative outlet that isn't writing.
Yes.
Like, if you're going from recreationally writing and really enjoying it to trying to make it a profession, you need another creative outlet of some sort. Like, cross stitch, crochet, draw a thing, whatever, because it's kind of hard to write for fun when you mostly write for money. And you need to get that out somehow.
So Ashley,
has an amazing 30-minute video on activating the creative mode.
Yes,
so he did this talk in Germany in like 1980 or something. It's funny while he talks about it, but basically that's what he breaks down. And John Cleese was one of the Monty Pythons.
Yeah.
Easily one of the most creative people on the planet, working on one of the most creative teams on the planet. And like, you just need to access your creative mode. So crochet, I play Overwatch, like whatever gets you in a playful mood. But you should really watch the whole video because it's much more nuanced.
So Ashley, can I ask you something then?
Sure.
You've taught classes on stuff. You've worked workshops. What is number one advice you would give to someone?
I would say to make the act of creating just as exciting as the act of sharing and publishing. Mm-hmm. I feel like when I'm working with writers, they have very ambitious goals, which I think is great. But sometimes they're thinking too far ahead. They're thinking about the design and the cool art they're going to commission and all the other stuff that I agree is really exciting. But then they get discouraged when they have to sit down and actually do the work. But I think if you could find a process that really excites you and inspires you, that you'll always be excited to write and produce content, even if it's never necessarily going to see the audience that you're expecting. And I just think that writers like need to have realistic goals. It doesn't mean you can't be ambitious, but I just think that when you make writing something that you do for yourself, with understanding that you're writing for an audience still, but still think that like just the actual process of writing, like I love to just pick my writing tools and get really excited about like actually putting together a story is really fulfilling to me. So that makes everything else that comes afterward like just icing on the cake, but I don't get discouraged when it starts to get hard, because it always gets hard in every writing project. And there was a video I shared in my writing workshop about by Jod Abumrad, who does the Radiolab podcast, and he talks about every creative process you get kind of lost in the German forest, which is related to a story that he was doing for Radiolab. But basically that like you have to get lost, you have to get stuck.
Yep.
And that's kind of how you work through those creative obstacles. And when you get to the other side, you know that you're on the right track. So I think that just like making sure that the writing process is what's really fulfilling you and not just the glory that you think comes with writing, because sometimes there's not glory and sometimes people hate it. And that's okay, it's part of the process.
Never. Everyone loves everything you write.
Oh my God, no. So I feel like if you have like kind of that strong sense of self, even though, I mean, I feel imposter syndrome all the time, but everyone I still does. Know, everyone does, but I feel like I still know at my core, like who I am as a writer and what I enjoy writing. And I can always come back to that regardless of everything else. So I would say that's my advice, is just to enjoy the process and make it fulfilling.
Mike, how many times a year do you get a pitch for a full campaign setting or other campaign setting size book?
Oh, people don't send me pitches for that. No,
they don't.
So I'm not a publisher.
Oh, that's right. I'm the only publisher here. Guess what? I get it like 5 times a year. I got pitched recently for an 80,000 word book. And I'm like, that's wonderful and great and awesome, but I can't do that.
I figured it out the other day what my title is. I'm an indirect market design house.
I can see that. That's good. Yeah.
No, it took me 5 years to figure out how to articulate that.
Mike, labels aren't so important.
Well, when I have to explain it to somebody quickly, it's very helpful.
I'm currently owner and producer at Little Red, and now I'm the line manager for Starfinder and Pathfinder, but Frog God. Not Frog God. Oh, I keep saying Frog God. Fat Goblin every time. Why do I say that? I've never worked
for Frog God. They're all lawyers, so you really should stop saying that. They are all lawyers over there. And that's not a joke.
Curse, yes, I swear, I work for you. But yeah, the ambition thing gets in the way of a lot of pitches I get. I get a lot of people who are like there's I think I've only accepted like a handful of external pitches because the ones that I accepted were like, here's a class, it's mostly done. Can you look it over and produce it? Yeah, sure. Here's most of the profits.
I had somebody pitch me. They were like, "Oh, I want to do the Seven Samurai as a side quest." That it was for $3,000. I was like, "Dude, like, it's a good idea, and people like it, and we'll talk about this. But like, what's your experience level?" Because I was immediately like, "You have no idea how many words it's going to take."
Yeah.
I had a publisher.
Well,
send
the Seven Samurai is a
4-hour movie
story.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're gonna do it. I'm thinking probably 8,000 or 9,000. Most of which
I'll write. I had a really good experience for a young writer, kind of tying what you said and what I said, Ashley, a little bit, was that when you start to write for, sorry, Ham, when you start to write for, as a freelancer, they go, you have 2,500 words to get this topic across. And you go, okay. And then you realize 2,000 words in, you haven't gotten to what you wanted to say. And you go, oh. How can I make this interesting in 2,500 words? I have to go back to the drawing board a bit. And I think another thing is like brevity is, there's some like good like phrase for this, but it's like a good designer can be brief and still effective.
Mm-hmm.
A good storyteller can be brief and still tell a great story.
Brevity is the something of good wit.
Yeah, that I can't remember what it is. Apparently, like we're not very good at it.
Brevity is something of good wit. Yeah, that's what it is.
Well, no,
yeah.
No, that's why we're writers, not public speakers.
Good, yeah. Good.
True.
All right, Ashley. Well, thanks once again for being on the show. We had a good time. Hope you didn't get terribly scared of us.
Not at all.
No. Awesome, awesome. Well, you brought some class to this program, and it was badly lacking because, you know.
Soul of wit. Brevity is the soul.
There you go, Mike. See, writers, like, it just takes us a while to figure it out. All right, so because brevity is the soul of wit, I'm going to end the stream immediately.
Thank you for coming.